Okay, so here we are. We have just had a look at the body contemplation and the idea of what it means to contemplate the body internally, externally, and also internally and externally. And then the section which comes after that is all about the arising and the vanishing nature of the body. But I will leave this part out because I don't think it is the most important part of the body contemplation. The most important part is internally, externally, and internally and externally, because it occurs across the board in all the various versions of the Satipatthana Sutta. We could talk about the rest, but time is getting quite short, so we'll just skip that, I think, and move on to the next part of this. So then we have the next contemplation, which is the kind of the one of the most important ones for body contemplation, the four elements, and it goes as follows. On page 45, if you can't find it, and bhikkhus, again bhikkhus, a bhikkhu reviews this same body, however it is placed, however disposed by way of elements, thus. In this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. Just as though a skilled butcher or his apprentice had killed the cow and was seated at the crossroads with it cut up into pieces, so too a bhikkhu reviews the same body by way of the elements, thus. In this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. So again, it is about one's own body that one does this first and foremost. This is always the most important one, because it is the attachment to our own body that leads to problems when it comes to samadhi practice. And the strange things in the suttas is not just that it leads to problems in samadhi practice, but it's also the case that the reason why we get attracted to other people is because of our attachment to our own body in the first place. So by reducing that attachment, we're reducing kind of the defilements across the board. So it's a very useful thing to do. And that is why it is the first part of the Satipatthana practice, so reducing the coarsest aspects of the defilements. And this particular practice is something that everybody can try every now and again, and it's quite easy to do. It's just reminding yourself that your body is no different from the external elements. We're all the same, right? When your body, where does it come from? It arises from the kind of the elements outside. It is no different from the, you know, the wooden floor here is in essence no different from the body. Same kind of elements that are there. Hardness, fluidity, air, and also a degree of heat. And when you remember that the body comes, you know, quite likely there are lots of elements in this floor here that has existed in people before, right? Some of your ancestors might be in this floor here, yeah? Quite likely. It's terrible. We're walking on our ancestors every time we walk back and forth here. But that's the nature of things, of material things. They're always interchanging back and forth. And this is why the physical body is, once you see it like that, you can't really distinguish anymore from the external elements. It arises from that and it goes back to that again when you pass away. If you want to read more about that, you can have a look at the Majjhima Nikaya 28, the greater sutta on the elephant's footprint. It is all about the contemplation of the four elements, and it gives a quite a nice description of that in quite great detail. But the basic idea is very simple, that the internal elements are no different from the external elements. So why are we attaching to this body? It is not really different from anything else, so we have to let it go at the end of the day. Okay, and then we have the same kind of inside section about internally. You watch your own body first of all, then you see the same is true for other people's bodies, and then eventually you get to the universal understanding. All bodies are of the same nature. None of them are really worth attaching to as a consequence. So there you are. So that is the contemplation of the body for you, the two most important ones. But as I was saying yesterday, the most important of all of the contemplations of the body is actually the mindfulness of breathing here. And we will have a look at that sutta later on, because it draws in all the aspects of Satipatthana into one nice and actually quite easy to understand sutta. So we'll check it out later on here. Okay, then we move on to the second Satipatthana, and one of the things to realize when you do Satipatthana practice is that in Buddhism, everything is in a certain sequence. Everything has a structure. Nothing is really random. And what that means is that the most basic aspect of Satipatthana is the contemplation of the body. Then comes the contemplation of feeling, then the contemplation of mind, and finally the contemplation of dhammas. Sequence is everything in Buddhism. It's important to remember that. So we start with the basic stuff and then move on. So feeling already getting more advanced. And this will become very clear once we look at the Anapanasati Sutta. So, how is this done? And this is how you do it. How, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating feeling as feeling? Or if you like, abide contemplating some aspects of feelings. Here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, a bhikkhu understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. When feeling a painful feeling, he understands, I feel a painful feeling. When feeling a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When feeling a worldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly pleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly pleasant feeling. When feeling a painful, worldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel a worldly painful feeling. When feeling an unworldly, something gone wrong there, hasn't it? Okay, when feeling an unworldly painful feeling, he understands, I feel an unworldly painful feeling. When feeling a worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel a neither worldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When feeling an unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands that he feels an unworldly, neither painful nor pleasant feeling. I got the feelings a bit mixed up there, but that's the way it goes. So the idea here is just basically to understand feelings in their full scope. And this is one of those very profound things in the Buddhist teachings. If you fully understand all feelings, essentially that is awakening itself. And the idea here is you can see there is some very obvious contrast here, on the one hand, between worldly feelings and unworldly feelings. And these are samisa sukha and niramisa sukha. And samisa means like carnal, to do with the flesh, to do with the physical body. And niramisa means not to do with the physical body. In other words, higher kind of feelings, samadhi and that kind of thing. And that is the important distinction here between worldly and unworldly. Once you get into samadhi, you're already kind of moving out of the world, right? Moving to a different plane. Which is equivalent to, of course, the planes of rebirth when it comes to the jhanas and these kind of things. So moving out of the world, you're becoming unworldly. That's quite cool, and to become unworldly. That is what is happening here. And of course, this is a very important distinction, because this distinction is what you have to understand to move forward in your practice of meditation. This is what we're talking about before. We're talking about the idea of doubt, and the problem with doubt is the lack of understanding between the skillful and the unskillful. So what we're doing here is contemplating the skillful and the unskillful to have clarity about the difference. Niramisa versus samisa. What is worldly? What is unworldly? And getting clarity about that. And as you get that clarity, you start to be able to progress on this path, make this distinction. And of course, another important part is also the understanding of the difference between happiness, unhappiness, and neutral feeling, or upekkha. It's very obvious that happiness is better than suffering. Everybody can kind of get that. That's an easy one to understand. But then also to move from there to understand that the upekkha, the neither painful nor pleasant feeling, is actually a higher feeling again, even beyond the happy feelings. And this is part and parcel of this contemplation. So again, it turns on this idea of abandoning defilements, abandoning the refined problems, on the Buddhist path, this is what it kind of turns on, and this is what is important here. And the whole Satipatthana, in a sense, concerns that, ending those final little defilements of the mind that stop us from going all the way and experiencing true unity, happiness, meaning of life, and all of these other wonderful things that arises just from samadhi. And samadhi is not even the end of the path, right? Samadhi is just one nice kind of start point, or not start point, that's the wrong way of thinking about it, is one of the kind of, almost getting there, but not quite there yet. What was that? One of the milestones, you can argue. That's a very good way of putting it. So it's a milestone. So when you come to the milestone, that's what they have in the old, they have these little stones along the road. So you come to the samadhi stone, right? And it comes there. Yeah, that's the way it works. So that's great. Okay, so again, one of the interesting things here is, how do we actually practice this? It sounds okay, you sort of read it, and then but when you start to think about it, it's actually not very clear how we're supposed to practice this. And there's a lot of disagreement in the Buddhist world. People would teach you different ways of how to do the Vedana Nupassana, the contemplation of feelings. You'll hear all kinds of different ways. And when I hear different ways of how these things are supposed to be contemplated and done, it always leaves me a bit confused, because who is right? How do you know who is right? And of course, the answer to this kind of thing is always to go back to the primary source of everything else. And of course, that is the Buddha himself. So how does the Buddha say that this contemplation of feeling should be done? And of course, what he says, and this is what he says again in the next sutta, is that it is through Anapanasati itself that you actually do the contemplation of feeling. That is what the Buddha suggests. So because the Buddha says that, I say this is the primary way that we should do feeling contemplation. I'm not saying that other ways are necessarily wrong. I'm just saying that this is, to me, the most powerful statement on the contemplation of feelings. And I'll show, we'll look later on and see how this is done. And what is very beautiful about that, when you do the contemplation of feelings in connection with Anapanasati, with mindfulness of the breath, what you are contemplating all the time is all the happy feelings, right? There's nothing in there about contemplating suffering, all of that. You leave that aside, and you just contemplate the joy and the happiness. That is really what it is about in the Anapanasati Sutta. And it gives a very kind of uplifting idea of Buddhist practice. Okay. So, that is the contemplation of feeling. And again, you do it internally. You do it externally. How do you do it externally? Well, I think you do it by inference. You know that other people must be feeling the same thing. You look at their face and you say, yeah, today you're not feeling too happy. Right? Or you look at the face, oh, today you must be feeling really, really well. So you can tell roughly what people feel just by looking at their behavior and these kind of things. And then, of course, again, you make this inference about every being's are bound by these kind of feelings. This is what it is like to be in existence, so to speak. Okay, so that is in brief the contemplation of feelings. And let us move on to the contemplation of mind. And it goes as follows. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating a mind or a mind state, a particular quality of mind in the mind? Or how does he abide contemplating a certain aspect of the qualities of mind? Here, a bhikkhu understands a mind affected by desire as a mind affected by desire, a mind unaffected by desire as a mind unaffected by desire. He understands a mind affected by ill will as a mind affected by ill will, and a mind unaffected by ill will as a mind unaffected by ill will. He understands a mind affected by delusion or confusion as a mind affected by delusion, and a mind unaffected by confusion as a mind unaffected by confusion. He understands the contracted mind as a contracted mind, and a distracted mind as a distracted mind. He understands the exalted mind as exalted, and the unexalted mind as unexalted. He understands the surpassed mind as the surpassed mind, and the unsurpassed mind as the unsurpassed mind. He understands the still mind as the still mind, and the unstilled mind as the unstilled mind. And he understands the liberated mind as the liberated mind, and the unliberated mind as the unliberated mind. So here again, we can see the same kind of pattern that we saw before, the idea that you are always comparing the unwholesome state of mind with the wholesome one. And of course, the idea here is to understand what is wholesome in the mind again, what is unwholesome, and on that basis, then to overcome the unwholesome and build up the wholesome. So this is always this contrast between the good states and the bad states you see throughout. So exactly the same thing as before. And just to give you some idea what these slightly cryptic terms, what they actually mean, a contracted mind means usually the mind of sloth and torpor and tiredness, because it's like contracted inside, right? You don't really, you feel like you can't really, your mind is kind of narrow and small inside of you. It has this contracted kind of sense to it. And distracted is then the mind which is restless, right? Agitated and going outside. So you can see here the hindrances here are kind of spoken about in various ways. And that summarizes the five hindrances right there. Huh? And then you have the opposite, and these are the exalted mind and unexalted mind. These are the mahagata citta, the mind gone great, right? The large mind that you have developed through your meditation and metta and these kind of things. Surpassed mind and unsurpassed mind is called the anuttara citta in Pali. And anuttara, all of these words that we're seeing now have to do with high states of samadhi. We're talking about jhanas and brahma viharas and these kind of things. The stilled mind, same thing again. The liberated mind also often refers to jhana and samadhi. And of course, sometimes it refers to the final liberation as well of arahantship. But here I think the main import is the idea of samadhi, because we are moving towards samadhi as we're trying to head with this contemplation. So that's roughly the meaning. And again, the importance here is to be able to distinguish between good and bad mind states. And again, the way it is done according to the Buddha, the way these things is practiced, is by through mindfulness of breathing here. When you do the mindfulness of breathing, there comes a point when you really start to get a feeling for what the mind is, because you are going beyond the five senses. And this is one of those things, is that if you want to know what something is, you have to kind of extract it from its environment, right? And the same thing with the mind. You have to extract the mind from its environment. And that environment is the five senses and the body. All of these things will kind of obscure what the mind is all about. And by extracting it, you can actually see the mind for what it actually is in its own right. And this is what we're trying to do on this path, extracting the gold, right? And this is quite literally what we're doing. It's like gold mining. This is what that simile of the soil remover is all about in the Gutra 3-100. And it literally compares the mind to gold, because the mind is, if you deal with it properly, it is the highest kind of, can give you the highest kind of happiness that anything can give you in the world. So that is why it is compared to gold. So we are, in a sense, gold mining here. We're all gold miners. But this is the real gold. It's not the kind of the fake gold outside, the kind of the earrings and that kind of stuff. This is the real deal. So that's the... Okay. So that is the mind contemplation, the citta nupassana. And then let us have a look at the dhamma nupassana, which is the last one. And I should maybe say, first of all, that both the Vedana Nupassana, the contemplation of feeling, and the Chitta Nupassana, the contemplation of mind qualities, these things are almost exactly the same across all Buddhist traditions. And that is why I didn't kind of pick anything in particular out, because it is pretty much the same everywhere. But when it comes to the mind Dhamma Nupassana, it is a bit different again, because Dhamma Nupassana, again, we find large variations across the various Buddhist traditions. So the question arises, what are the original parts of Dhamma Nupassana? And according to the studies that I have read, and they make like tables that tabulate the various things that exist across the different traditions, the most ancient aspect of the of this part is the contemplation of the five hindrances and the contemplation of the seven factors of awakening. Yeah, so these are the most important parts of the Dhamma Nupassana, it seems. Which is very interesting, because there is a lot of similarity between these things. The hindrances and the contemplation of the bhujangas are very often found together in the suttas in many different places. They kind of belong together as opposites, if you like. When you get rid of the hindrances, the bhujangas happen automatically. When you develop the bhujangas, you are reducing the hindrances. These are like opposites. They kind of counteract each other. And this is why you have to abandon the hindrances to move into the bhujangas. This is why you develop the bhujangas to undermine the hindrances. They always go together in this way. So they are a pair that match together very well, and it's natural to see them together in a place like the Satipatthana Sutta. And what is also interesting about this, and we will see this in a second, is that all the contemplation here on the five hindrances and the bhujangas is all about conditionality. It's all about understanding how these things arise, how they come into existence, with a deeper understanding of the defilements of the mind. And I think this is kind of the main meaning here behind the idea of Dhamma Nupassana, because the idea of Dhamma Nupassana is a bit hard to grasp exactly what it means. It is often said to mean contemplation of mind objects, because the word Dhamma can mean the objects of the mind. But the point is that we have already looked at mind objects already, right? We've just been looking at the various things in the mind, the desire, the ill will, and these kind of things. Feelings are also mind objects in a certain way. So it doesn't really fit the bill 100%. And I think, and this is been suggested originally by Ajahn Sujata, I think it's a very nice point, is that Dhamma Nupassana really refers to the contemplation of the conditionality, contemplation of the connection between how these different factors arise in the mind. What is the origin of these factors? And that is what it refers to. So sometimes it can perhaps be translated as contemplation of principles, because Dhamma has this idea of principles. It means like nature sometimes. Law, right, is one of the meanings of Dhamma. The law of nature, how nature functions. And of course, one of the most essential aspects of how nature functions is conditionality. Certainly from a Buddhist point of view, everything is conditionality. And this is why dependent origination is such a crucial part of the Buddhist worldview. Okay, so now let's have a look at this and see what... And if you don't understand what I'm talking about, please raise your hand and we can kind of do things in a bit more detail, because I'm kind of speaking a bit fast today, perhaps, because I'm kind of worried about all these pages ahead of us, and we only have a couple of more hours left, so I'm kind of rushing around. But that's probably the wrong attitude to have anyway. So let's see what it has to say here. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating principles, certain principles among principles? Here, a bhikkhu abides contemplating certain principles in terms of the five hindrances. And how does the bhikkhu abide contemplating some aspects of the principles in terms of the five hindrances? Here, there being sensual desire in him, a bhikkhu understands there is sensual desire in me. Or there being no sensual desire in him, he understands there is no sensual desire in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the abandoning of arisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. So here, this is what we mean by insight and understanding and vipassana and contemplation of various things, is to understand them according to their conditioned nature. And if you understand something very thoroughly, it means that you understand also how to get rid of it, because you understand how it actually comes into being in the first place. So the first thing here is to understand there is sensual desire. And as I said before, this is not as simple as it may sound, because sensual desire has some very refined aspect to it. So we're here talking about the whole spectrum of sensual desire, from the worst kind of most powerful desire to the most refined, tiny, miny, very small desire on the other end, and you understand the whole thing, because everything across the board is going to hinder you in your samadhi practice. And often the way that you come to understand the desire fully is actually by abandoning it. Only when you have abandoned it fully do you know that you have fully understood what sensual desire is about. Once you climb up that mountain I was talking about before, once you come out of the jungle, only then can you really understand what these things are. So we try our very best as we practice to understand this, but the final real insight comes when one day you hit that samadhi peak and you think, whoa, now I see what's going on, right? Gee, this is what it means. And then you have that kind of insight as to what actually is happening. Then you have seen both where sensual desire, what it is, and also you understand what it isn't. You understand the escape from sensual desire for the first time. So if you have never actually achieved any deep samadhi yet, it means that there is some aspect of sensual desire still there, some attachment to something, some desire. You may feel very pure inside, right? You meditate, you don't really think about anything, you can't see any defilements in your mind, but still there's some very tiny thing there which you are attaching to and holding on to. You wouldn't normally even think of it as sensual desire, because as I was saying, it's a very broad spectrum, but some degree of attachment is still going on. And this is often what hinders us from reaching proper samadhi. So this is what this is about, fully understanding these things. And yes, please, yeah. Give an example of that. Well, sometimes it's hard to. So an example would be you are watching the breath, right? And you're watching the breath and you want to go further. Maybe you're trying to make the breath become more refined and even getting the breath to disappear, so you can move on to the stage where you see things like nimittas and that sort of thing. But then the breath doesn't want to disappear, right? The breath is kind of sitting there, holding on. And part of that is because you have some attachment to the breath, which is part of the body. And you are even afraid sometimes if the breath starts to disappear. So this is one of them. One of the things people often talk about in the meditation, when the breath goes completely, it's weird. Oh, my breath is disappearing. Will I die now? What is going to happen now? And there isn't really any problem with that. If your breath disappears, all it means is that you're not aware of it anymore. But the body is capable of breathing on its own. You don't actually have to watch over it. Otherwise, we can never fall asleep, right? That would be problematic for us if we can never sleep. So this is the thing. And also when it comes to the nimitta stage, you are afraid of moving on into the jhanas, because there is this feeling that you have to let go of something, right? It's the feeling inside of you to move from a nimitta to a jhana state. You have to let go of something. And that feeling is scary, because we are so used to having certain things around us. We're used to having a sense of freedom of will, or being able to choose for ourselves. We have a sense of vision, being able to see the nimitta, whatever. Now we have to let go of all of that. And letting go is always scary, because it is considered, we see it as something which is part of ourselves. It's our identity that we're letting go of. And letting go of who you are is always going to be frightening to some extent. Actually, it's just happiness, right? And after a while, you kind of get that idea. But it seems scary when you start doing it. Sometimes I heard of people, it's very kind of sweet. They go on a meditation retreat and they become a little bit peaceful. And they can't feel the parts of the body anymore. And they, help, I can't feel the parts of my body, right? And that is kind of a very kind of serious, very coarse, if you like, attachment to the body right there. So you can see these things in many, many aspects and variations. Yes. How to not be afraid. Well, how not to be afraid is that you learn these things gradually. You see as you move into these things, you see that things ceasing and things ending actually is a positive thing. You see that at the very beginning, if you become a little bit more peaceful already, you understand that all that other stuff, all the thinking mind, all the things going on, actually it was a problem, right? It causes suffering. So while you're thinking, you are attached to that, but suddenly you realize, actually, I don't need that after all.
So you start to get little insights from the very beginning when things become more peaceful. You see, every time you abandon something, you feel more happy. Okay, check out some more, right? That's kind of the sort of insight you get. Check out some more stuff, and then maybe become even more happy. And then it goes gradually like that. You understand where real happiness is, and you understand where suffering is gradually as you move into this. So this is how the fear disappears gradually. Yes, sir. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So is that a kind of attachment? If you enjoy the, it can be. You know, sometimes it can be. Sometimes we do get attached to happy feelings. But the thing is that what you have to do, you have to go through that, because those happy feelings, that is actually the path to go to even happier feelings. So then you go to that, and then if you find that there is some attachment, you learn to deal with that later on. But we're already attached to happy feelings, right? We're already attached to our whatever it is in the world, our nice food, our relationships, whatever it is. So you are kind of just moving from one attachment to a more refined one. You let go of some of those coarser attachments, move to something a bit more refined. And what is nice about that is that as you move from a coarse attachment to a more refined one, the grip of attachment itself is loosening a little bit. It's not so strong anymore. The attachment tends to be stronger, the kind of the more coarse it is. So you learn to deal with those things. It's not really a solution to avoid that happiness, because then you will never go anywhere on the path. So you have to learn to deal with it instead. Okay. And one of the things about those happy feelings as well is that the attachment often happens afterwards. It doesn't often happen while you have those happy feelings, but after you come out of that samadhi or that, you know, positive mindset, that's often when you attach to these things. And then that stops you from actually going back in again later on. So that is one of the problems there. But while you are there, there is no real attachment, because attachment actually has to be given up to enter those things in the first place. Okay, so sensual desire, you know that it's there, you know that it is absent, and then you understand how it comes into being, right? How is there the arising of the sensual desire? And of course, this is a very important point, because if you understand how sensual desire arises, then you are more aware of when it is about to come into being. You have more ability to move in a different direction and look at things in a different way. So, and how does sensual desire arise? Right, how it arises is because you're looking for the beautiful in something. You're seeing the subha aspect of something. And when you see the beautiful aspect of something, that is where often a desire arises in regard to that object. So you can start, if you understand the connection between looking for the beautiful and seeing the sense of desire, then you can get the feeling for when desire is about to arise. Just be aware of what you're attending to. Be aware of how you are attending to that object, right? And the how, for example, if you see a nice car, you think, wow, I really would like to have a red Ferrari, right? And many people would like to have a red Ferrari. I'm sure most of you here are far beyond that, but you're so wise. But sometimes it's like, oh, strange desires arise in us. So when you see that, you instead of then attaching or kind of continuing a contemplation of how beautiful the Ferrari is, you remind yourself, well, once you have it, it's not going to be so exciting anymore. Then there's some kind of crazy driver probably will drive into you and crash your Ferrari, and then you get really, really angry, right? Because this is my Ferrari, it is so important to me. And then you remember kind of the debt that you have to go into to pay this Ferrari. It's going to be a hassle. You remember that eventually it's going to start falling apart. It's impermanent anyway. It's going to disintegrate. And you remember all the negative sides. You remember all the hassle you're going to have with looking after it, right? If you have a red Ferrari, you have to polish it all the time so the color is nice, and you have to kind of all of these things, right? And oh, so much headache to having these Ferraris. So that is how you think of the negative side of things. And then, of course, when you look, either you look away completely, not really focusing on that object, Or you remember the opposite side of the coin. And when you remember the reverse side of the coin, the negative side, again, the desire doesn't allow you to arise. You don't allow the desire to arise as a consequence. So this is how we deal with this. This is kind of the idea here. You understand the causality. Once you understand the causality, you can actually do something about it. Okay. So, and how there comes to be the abandoning of the arisen sensual desire. In other words, you don't focus on that positive aspect of things, the beautiful aspect. And how there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. And you understand that that comes through, first of all, samadhi practice, because you see the mind in samadhi is beyond these things, and eventually through insight itself, and you destroy that sensual desire at its root. So this is quite interesting, isn't it? This is all about how to really get to the core of these defilements of the mind, how to deal with them. And this is what Satipatthana, a large part of Satipatthana, is actually about. Okay, then we have similar kind of ideas for all the other five hindrances. So exactly the same sequence for the other five hindrances. So you have ill will, you understand what it is, you understand when it's absent, you understand how it arises. Right? How does ill will arise? It arises because you see the negative side in something. You see the kind of repulsive side of another human being, the side you don't want to see, the kind of the negative aspect. And of course, in this case, again, it's exactly the same thing as with sensual desire. You have to shift your attention and see the positive in that person, either, as we were saying before, by seeing the good qualities in your fellow members of the BDF or whatever it is, or by having compassion for that person, understanding that they, whatever negative qualities they have, they are the ones who have real problems with these things. So again, understanding the causality here is so powerful. And then, so then you understand the abandoning, and you also understand the future non-arising, which happens exactly the same way as with samadhi, as with the sensual desire before. Then we have the sloth and torpor, and the restlessness and remorse, and to a very large extent, these things, they fade away when the first two hindrances fade away. The two first ones are by far the most important ones, and they are the ones that kind of underlie all the other hindrances of the mind. But they also have some degree, of course, of independent existence as well. And so sloth and torpor, or tiredness of the mind, it comes about also because you are contemplating, you're looking at things in a certain way, and then the mind becomes tired. Maybe you're exerting yourself too much, or you're trying too hard, or using your willpower. You're not allowing the mind to kind of still down instead. Restlessness and remorse are very, again, the same kind of thing. There are certain ways of looking at the world which leads to this problem. If you do that, again, using willpower and this kind of thing, instead you focus on that object which gives rise to peace, the breath or whatever it is, and then you actually overcome these things simply by doing that. And then there is doubt, and exactly the same thing again happens for doubt. You allow the doubt to, you understand it, you allow it, you understand the causes, and then you understand how it disappears by investigating things properly, understanding what really is, where happiness really lies, what are wholesome states, what are unwholesome states, and then you have the chance to abandon the doubt as well. But the two first ones are what are most important, and that's why I've looked at those in most detail. So, then you contemplate these things internally about yourself. You understand that it also affects other people, and then internally and externally, it is universal. There is no escape from these hindrances in this world, right? There is an escape, but it's only temporary. You go to the Brahma Loka, you hang out there and enjoy that for a while, and then bang, you come back into the human world, and the hindrances come back again. So that's why you have to make an end of them once and for all. As far as existence is concerned, hindrances are always going to be there. Okay, Okay, let's start with the enlightenment factors. We've got to use our time to the max. Please tell me if I go on for too long, because I'm not exactly sure what the schedule is today, but I'll go on to 10:11:30 to the dot at the very least. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu abides contemplating these principles, certain principles, among principles, in terms of the seven enlightenment factors. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating certain principles in terms of the seven enlightenment or awakening factors? Here, there being the mindfulness awakening factor in him, a bhikkhu understands there is the mindfulness awakening factor in me. And there being no mindfulness awakening factor in him, he understands there is no mindfulness awakening factor in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of the unarisen mindfulness awakening factor, and how the arisen mindfulness awakening factor comes to fulfillment. By development. Again, there seems to be some problem there with the text. Comes to fulfillment by development. So here the idea again is exactly the same thing as before. You understand what these things are, and you understand it through your personal experience. And again, the idea of causality, right? How does mindfulness actually arise? And you see this for yourself. And what you see, of course, is that it arises through the purity of the mind. So it arises through your practice of virtue, your practice of dealing with the mind in the right way. And as you do that, you find, wow, your mindfulness actually is improving. You're no longer being pulled about by the desires that take you into the future, by the anger that often takes you into the past. That purity of the mind leaves you evenly going through this world with a high degree of mindfulness, ideally. So that is where it comes from, this factor. Then you also understand how it comes to fulfillment, right? And of course, the way that it comes to fulfillment is by, once you do that, once you have a certain degree of purity, etc., then you keep on practicing also the satipatthanas, eventually the samadhi, and as the hindrances become more and more suppressed, the mind becomes more and more pure, the mindfulness becomes more and more powerful. And this is one of those interesting things that people, I think, often don't quite understand from the suttas, is that mindfulness has a large number of degrees. You can have a little bit of mindfulness, you know what is going on roughly, you don't allow yourself to become angry and these kind of things. So a little bit of mindfulness, and then the mindfulness goes up because you have even less defilements. And as you move up the path, the mindfulness becomes more and more powerful. You're more and more focused in the present moment, more precisely aware of what is going on, right? And of course, a lot of that mindfulness, the power of that mindfulness, comes through the samadhi practice. You see this in the places like the Indriya Samyutta. It talks about the strength of the indriyas being developed as your samadhi and your insight increases. And of course, one of the indriyas is the sat indriya, the mindfulness indriya. And as you go further on the path, the more powerful these indriyas become. And this is a very important point, because it means that sometimes people think, oh, mindfulness is just mindfulness. I'm just mindful, and then I can have insight based on that. But actually, what you really want is really powerful mindfulness, because that very powerful mindfulness has the ability to bore into the object, if you like, and then see it properly for what it actually is. I think I'm have to go now. Is that right, Lai? Okay, yeah. So that is just one thing that is so crucial, I think, and one of the things that comes out also here. Developing it, right, and bringing it to fulfillment through development means that we reach mindfulness to the very, very highest state. Okay, let's have a break for lunch, and then we'll see you again at 2:00 this afternoon.